Hello, and welcome to Sobercast. We provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in a podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Also, if you're a member of NA or have friends that are, please tell them about our other podcast, NAPOD. NAPOD features NA speakers and workshops in the same format as Sobercast. We upload a new speaker every day, and it's easy to subscribe by searching for NAPOD, N-A-P-O-D, all one word, on any podcast player app, or go to napod.xyz if you'd like to listen online. Hope you enjoy the podcast and have a great day.
Okay, I'm Libby. I'm an alcoholic. I'm probably not going to read this to you, but I'm just bringing it up here because it's like a nice little security blanket. My sober date is November 29, 1996. My home group is Magnolia on Thursday nights, and we've had the great blessing of having both the holidays here close by land on my home group's day. So my husband and I go down there and open up the church. And so if you have nowhere to go Thursday night, that's where I'll be. So, you know, it doesn't matter how many times I've stood in front of people and talked, I always still get nervous. And so I try to practice what I tell other people that I work with, which is that before I go up here, I pray and I ask my higher power to go with me, and I ask for honesty. Not so much because I'd come up here with a plan to lie or anything, but it's just easy to be grandiose, you know, as alcoholics. So I always ask for honesty as well. I grew up in a very alcoholic, very violent home. My father is the one who is pretty much a rager. And my mom liked to party too, but she was not, you know, she's not so much the rager. And I spent probably a pretty good portion of my life, once I did start drinking, kind of drinking at that. Drinking at those feelings, drinking at those people, you know. I spent a lot of years mad, and I didn't even know I was mad. So, you know, when I was a little girl, I was one of these straight-A students who was really quiet. I know that's hard to believe, but yeah, I was quiet. You know, I just kind of was always towing the line because I was just like constantly living in a state of fear and anxiety. And my belief was that if I kept things a certain way, then things would be okay, you know. Well, that never really worked out so well. When I got into middle school, I started finding different drugs and alcohol and things and people who did those things and, you know, kind of started experimenting, you know, and I also felt very awkward. I developed a little earlier than the other girls, and, you know, that brought really negative attention from the older females and really positive attention from the boys. And so I just kind of always felt awkward. And, you know, it probably wasn't until I came here and met some of you guys that I felt like that wasn't so weird. Because I heard a lot of you talk about how awkward you felt. Your story might not have been the same as mine, but you'd talk about feeling uncomfortable. And once I found alcohol, it was like it could take that away for me. It could take away the discomfort. It could take away the anxiety. It could take away the pain. It could take away the fear. You know, I kind of felt invincible. And and when I started drinking, I immediately started drinking as much as I could get, as long as I could get it, And I immediately had like kind of a psychotic tolerance, and it was kind of like a badge of honor. You know, I thought it was cool when I was in like eighth grade that I could drink more than the high school boys. And you know, nobody was around to tell me, hey, that might be a sign of alcoholism, you know? And it was normal. Like everybody in my family drank so much that when I landed in jail for drunken and disorderly and fighting with cops in eighth grade, this like shy, quiet, straight A student, you know, my mom wasn't really that alarmed. I mean, it wasn't a big deal. And when I started to have my own children and I was sober and I really was able to put that stuff into perspective, it just became so horrifying. I mean, it's like, so from a pretty young age, alcohol and my alcoholism had bad, bad consequences. Like it started out doing what I needed it to with the feelings, but it also immediately had consequences. So by the time I was, you know, probably 15, 16, I had already had like just so many terrible things happen to me that would not have happened if, well, you can't say that. Who knows if it would have happened, but I probably wouldn't have put myself in the position to have those awful things happen had I not been wasted. And that doesn't mean that the people who did the things weren't responsible for their part. And that was tricky for me. When I first got here and I heard people talking about these amends and God and all that, you know, I was one of those people who was ready to get up and bolt out the door. I mean, it just made me so uncomfortable in my skin. I was just like, I could not imagine how you tell somebody, you know, an amends that, you know, made you terrified and beat the crap out of you for a big chunk of your life. And what I got when I got here is that don't worry about that stuff. Just keep showing up. And, you know, when you get there, somebody's going to walk through it with you. And it's not, you know, it's not so much that we excuse somebody else's behavior when we make an amends, but we, you know, take responsibility for ours. So anyway, by the time I was 24, I was having, which often sounds really young to a lot of people and looked really young, I think, to people in my family. Because, you know, in my family, you know, you just drink to the bitter end. You know, I mean, there is no sobriety. And so I was 24. I had in the last year or two that I was married, I mean, not married, whew, drinking, same thing. No, just kidding. No, the last year or two that I was drinking, I had tried some really weird stuff to manage my drinking. Like, I had always thought I was an alcoholic. I just didn't think there was anything wrong with that, you know? I just didn't think there was anything to do about it, you know? By the time I was 23, 24, I was like, you know, the consequences, like, you know, dents on your car that you didn't know where they come from, you know, and, you know, losing a couple hours when you were supposed to meet friends from over here to over there, and you thought you just drove there, and you didn't because they were really worried because you didn't show up for 3 hours. That kind of stuff was a real regular occurrence at the end. And alcohol had also totally quit working the way I wanted it to. I can remember really distinctly, it was not my last drunk, but it was the first one where I was really, really conscious that it wasn't working. So it was about a month or two before I got sober. The last few years I was drinking, I had lost like one friend after another. I mean, it was like, it was crazy. My friends were dropping like flies. It was, you know, murder. It was suicide. It was heroin overdose. It was, you know, I mean, it's just over and over and over. So this last kid that died was about a year or two younger than me. And I am a little bit codependent. And he was the kind of guy that just always looked like a boy and you just wanted to bring him home and make soup for him, you know? I mean, you just wanted to do that. He was just that kind of guy, you know? And he was kind of like a little brother to me, you know? And when they found him, he'd been dead for 3 days because, you know, we get isolated. And they don't really know what killed him. They know he choked on his vomit, but they don't know if it was the drugs or the booze. It really doesn't matter, you know? But there was something about losing that friend. Like, all my other friends that I'd lost, I would be different than them in my mind. I could go, well, I didn't use heroin. Or, you know, I didn't, you know, I could come up with all these things, right? Well, with this guy, it was like, he was like a baby, you know, he's younger than me. And it was just, it just really struck me in a way nothing had before. And so I was with a bunch of really good friends, and I was very often the designated drunk driver because supposedly I could drive better drunk than other people could. I know, really fucked up, right? Because I was the kind of girl who could slam hard liquor all night, and my girlfriend, who was a normie, wouldn't even notice what I was drinking, wouldn't think I was drunk at all, but then couldn't get into our bathroom because I was, you know, face down on the floor, you know? So I would go from totally lucid and coherent to gone, you know, like that. It was crazy. So I lost my train of thought. I do that sometimes when I start distracting myself. Okay, so I was at my friend Demarese's funeral with a bunch of friends, and I was the driver. And we went up to Ernie Steele's afterwards to kill it. You know, we were going to get rid of that stuff, those feelings, you know. I didn't do feelings. I didn't like feelings. And so we went there, and at the time, it was one of my favorite whiskey bars, and we start drinking. And, you know, we're a couple hours in, and I'm getting irritated. I don't know if any of you experienced this, but I had gotten to the point where it wasn't working, you know? It was like, I was angry drinking, because I was like, what the hell? Come on, you know? It was not coming. And I was feeling everything. And this guy sat down across the table from me, I could kind of relate to what you were talking about, you know? This guy drank like I did. And I used to see him regularly at the Comet, and which was another of my watering holes up on Capitol Hill. And it was a lot dirtier then than it is now. I've seen it. It's a little cleaned up. It's got like bright windows now. It wasn't like that then. The darker, the better. Anyway, so this guy, Skip, he drank like I did, you know, and he was just randomly in the bar and chose, for whatever reason, to sit across from me and was drinking orange juice. Just orange juice. I mean, not only did I not understand why you would want to sit in a whiskey bar and drink orange juice, I really had no concept of how you could do that. I mean, I didn't get it. And so he gave me his number, and you know, I had a real negative opinion about most people, but especially men. No, I hated women too. It was pretty equal, you know. Mom taught me to hate men because they were out to kill you and rape you and use you. And Dad taught me to hate women because they were manipulative and they were out to use you. And I don't know. They just both gave me a head full of hating humanity. So what was I to do but drink at that, right? No, it's not their fault. Anyway, so he's sitting across from me drinking this juice, and I'm baffled, and I'm irritated because I can't take it away. You know, they talk about in the book the restless, irritable, and discontented until we can take that first drink. When you get to the point where that drink doesn't do that for you anymore, it sucks. And so he did not, like you said, he did not throw a book at me or anything. I mean, it was enough that he was just sitting there drinking juice after juice, which is also a funny thing. I did that in New Sobriety, too. I'd go to clubs to see my friends' bands play, and I would drink one club soda with lime in it after another. Okay, normal people don't drink 20 club sodas in an hour, you know? I mean, really. But I could not have my hand empty in the bar. I couldn't do it, you know? I mean, I shouldn't have been in the bar, but, you know, I wasn't real good at following suggestions early on, so... You know, it's kind of funny when I sponsor girls and they talk about the things they're doing wrong, the dating or the this or the that. Not wrong, but you know what I mean. The suggestions. Against the suggestions. I can't tell them, don't do that. Because I got into a really screwed up relationship when I was 2 months sober with a guy that had years more than me. And I hung around in nightclubs, you know, because a lot of my friends were musicians and bartenders. And so I hung around in those places for months, sober somehow. I mean, I don't know if I would call it sober. I was dry. I was clutching those club sodas tight, you know. And they'll give you free drinks too when you're not drinking booze. That was like phenomenal. I was like in shock. I was like, really? You give people that don't drink free stuff all night? I mean, that just seemed insane. So Skip gives me his number and he tells me, he says, I'm sober. And so if you, you know, decide you're done drinking, you know, you can call me, you know. Somehow we got on the subject because I'd asked him about the orange juice. So he gave me his phone number and he said, he basically told me he was out of his mind, okay? And he never slept. He was up at any hour and I could call him. So just to give you an example of how sick I was when I got here, that gave me hope, okay? And that guy was a dear friend to me in my early sobriety. And, you know, I know they talk about the women sticking with the women and the men with the men, but he was my first, like, kind of, you know, this guy gives me some hope because he feels as crazy as I feel or looks as crazy as I feel, and he still doesn't have to drink. So it kind of started out with just having this phone number, and I'd call him now and then. And, the crazy things I had tried to stop drinking. Damn it. See, I should have gotten sober first. That's what I usually like to do. He gave me his number and, a couple times I called him, you know, I wasn't really totally ready to be sober. But sometimes I would think I was, and we just go take walks in the rain in the middle of the night. And, you know, he never made any moves on me. He was not predatory in any way, shape or form. It was really cool. I mean, it was like one of my first experiences with somebody, in kind of those last years, really having good motives, you know, like really pure motives. And it was really cool. And I really kind of owe a lot of my early sobriety to this person. And I talked to them, him a few times about it, how grateful I was. But in the end of my drinking, I actually had tried a couple things to control my drinking. So not only did I have problems with booze and drugs and all that stuff, I also had, you know, like I said, a little codependency. So I was a serial monogamist. I would like be in one relationship after another, like back to back. I was never alone. And at the end of my drinking, like in the last couple years, I got sick of dating. I was just like, I don't want to date anymore. And I had this really delusional thought that, well, if you don't want to date anymore, you get married. So I married this guy. And it was a guy that I really didn't like that much. I had three options, okay? There were three guys I was kind of dating. One of them was a rock star. Another one, and I'm not going to tell you who, so don't ask. Another one was just a disgusting drunk like myself, contractor, whose house had just burned down, so he was sleeping at my house. And the third option was a guy who hated booze. And I really didn't like the guy that much. I wasn't even really that attracted to him, but I was like, well, he likes me and he doesn't like drinking. So if I'm with him, I will be able to control my drinking. So we got married really fast and didn't last. Just give you that ahead of time. Because I, you know, alcoholics are brilliant at finding loopholes. We will find loopholes anywhere they might exist. So I learned pretty quickly that my husband was a drug addict. And if we got high enough, he'd drink with me. And during that relationship, I also got to see that, you know, for me, a drug is a drug is a drug. I mean, if it's going to change my mood, change how I feel, I want it and I want all of it. Doesn't even matter what it is. And so, you know, he had most of the time we were together just been a pothead. So that for me with my alcoholism was fairly okay. Where it got ugly was right towards the end when he got into crystal meth. And he was bizarre. He could like keep this little bag of whatever it was in a drawer for like weeks or days, you know? And he never liked to share with me because if I got in anything with him, it was gone and I wanted to go to the dealer and he would get pissed, you know? So we had this really bizarre marriage that was like a lot of like hiding and guarding of stuff and, you know, me hiding when I was drinking. And, you know, I'd try to be a controlled drinker, you know, where I'd have like go out with my friends and have one drink. And I worked so hard to have that one drink that by the time I came home and had five and he said, "You're drunk, you know, and how many did you drink?" And I'd say one. And I did not feel like I was lying because I really tried hard to have one, you know, and it was painful, you know. So then I stopped hanging out with my friends, you know. And so as my drinking went on, it was like I would always change the bar, kind of like what you were saying. You know, I had rules and I would just constantly lower the bar, you know, to fit the situation. If things got in the way of my drinking, like when I started finding dents that I couldn't account for, I would just quit driving. I mean, I lived on Capitol Hill, you know, and I didn't see that as a problem, giving up your car, you know, because of hitting things. So anyway, so I've been calling this guy Skip. Oh, at the end, I was going through a divorce. I have medical issues as well that I discovered kind of right at the end of my drinking. I have apparently what's called a very sensitive system, you know. I'm kind of tightly wound, a little anxious, and just kind of naturally. And so I was having all these problems of my guts, and like I wasn't properly able to handle food anymore. And they gave it one diagnosis at these Western medical doctors, and I didn't really like the diagnosis very much. That was another thing that ran true for me. I wanted to run the show when it came to like anything medical. It was like, no, I don't like that option. Okay. So I'd go to like Bastyr and be like, what do you think? You know? And they wanted me to take this little pill so I could digest food. They didn't even think to ask me about alcohol or drug addiction or any of that. And I didn't want to take this little pill for the rest of my life. And so I went to Bastyr. Bastyr put me on an allergy elimination diet. I could not eat, okay, corn, tomatoes, wheat, dairy, sugar, coffee, cigarettes, booze, and it just went on, okay? And I had never been like more than a day or two without booze or cigarettes or, you know, that kind of stuff, coffee, you know? And so I went a month on this elimination diet, like just shortly before my friend died and shortly before I got sober. And I was psychotic. I was psychotic for that month. But systemically, I felt amazing. I was like, I process food normally. You know, this is awesome, you know? And still, no light bulbs about, you know, the other problems. But right at the end, I was sick all the time. I'd done this. Oh, the end of the 30 days, I was supposed to introduce one thing at a time back into my diet. And I was supposed to do that every second or third day and journal, you know? So the first day, I was up on Broadway, and I don't know if any of you are familiar with Capitol Hill, but I went to one side of the street where there was a convenience store and bought a pack of cigarettes, started smoking, went next door to the Vivace Coffee and got a latte, and I went back across the street and got some chocolate at Dilettante, and then went next door to Eileen's and started drinking whiskey. And that's how this alcoholic reintroduces things slowly. So my point telling you all that is that my brain was so screwed up. I totally relate to what it says in the book that we have an allergy of the body and the mind, you know, because even not having booze in me for 30 days and all those other toxins, you know, I'm just rip roaring to go the second my brain takes off, you know, and makes a decision. That was funny. I always thought I made decisions, you know, when I would take things, you know, but I really never did. I hate it when I do this. This is why I should have gotten sober first. So eventually I am sick enough. I still am not ready. I go 30 days dry. I go to one meeting that this friend of mine told me to go to. I go there and they call on me and I'm just mortified. And I lift, you know, we all know what that scared newcomer looks like. Their head. Okay, if you're new and you don't want to be called on, don't sit like this, you know. Don't like have your head all the way down and not looking at everybody. Look right at them. No. So of course they called on me and I just didn't get any of this. I really didn't get anything for a while. And I kind of lifted my head up and said, I'm Libby and I don't know what I am. Please don't call on me, and put my head back down. So then I was dry 30 days again, doing same thing I'd done in the summer when I was, you know, sick. Thanksgiving was my last drunk, Thanksgiving in 1996. And that next day, I really had... you know, the four horsemen, you know, description in the book, if you've read it, you know, I really was bewildered, you know, terrified. I was sick. I woke up in a strange place, you know. Since I've been sober, I never wake up somewhere and not know where I am. I never lose my car. I never have dents on my car that I don't know where they came from. I don't know. There's just so many different things. So I was a slow learner in every regard. There's a spiritual experience appendix in the back of the book, and that was where I relate. I didn't follow directions well right away. If you do, you're awesome. Go for it. It'll be way easier for you than it was for me. And if you don't, I hope you stay sober. You know, I mean, I don't know how I did it through some of that time. I always had sponsors and stuff, but it took me about 3 or 4 years before I really could make a connection with another woman. I was damaged cookie. When it talks in here about needing outside help, that's for reals. If you need outside help, go get it, you know, because AA can't do everything for some of us. Some of us need some extra help, and I needed that. And really it saved my life. So I had been in therapy for many years before I came to AA, but I could never really use the tools I was getting because I was using, you know, when I got sober and started working a program and working with a sponsor and stuff like that and doing the steps, it was amazing. I could utilize all these tools I had, you know, kind of gathered up and was unable to use over the years. So it took me a few years to relate to another woman. So I picked women early on that are wonderful women. They're fabulous people. There's nothing wrong with them. I could not relate to people. And so it took me a long time to finally connect to a sponsor. And best sponsor I ever chose was the one I didn't choose. I was a appointed kind, well, not really appointed, I don't like that word. So a really good friend of mine whose recovery I totally loved, she was awesome. And I loved the way she'd talk about spiritual things. It was in a language I could understand, because some of the language here I didn't always feel like I connected to. And so she said to me, go to my sponsor. She's awesome. Okay. And it was one of the true acts of faith that I did, because I was like, I was desperate. And I was, you know, 3-4 years sober. I'd married a sober guy. We'd had 2 kids. We had a house. And I was nuts again, sober. And I didn't have a sponsor. And so she told me about her sponsor. So then I start stalking Julia. I mean, it really felt like I was stalking her. I followed her around from meeting to meeting and I waited for her to talk. She never talked. So finally, I was in enough pain. I just went up to her and I said, I don't know you at all, but my friend Liza thinks you're fabulous and I need a sponsor. I need help. And I think it was probably the first time that I really, really meant it with a sponsor. And we went and I think we had lunch or dinner or something. And we talked, and the way that she talked was plain and simple. It was in a language that I could understand. I know I've said that a couple times, but I didn't understand it when people would regurgitate quotes from the big book, and I didn't understand it when I just didn't understand a lot of language. But when she talked, I would tell her something, and if she had an experience that related to that, she'd share it with me, you know? And that was the kind of help I needed, you know? So that's how I sponsor girls. And the other thing she did with me that felt like such a miracle to me, because I thought I had seen some arrogance. I don't know if I did or not, but I thought I did. A lot of arrogance and hierarchical stuff regarding the sponsorship thing, and I just didn't relate to that. She had none of that, zero. And if she didn't know something, she would say, I don't have experience with that. I don't know. And she'd say, would you like me to help you find somebody that you could talk to about that? Because I think so-and-so would do that. And, you know, that's another tool I got from her that I do with girls when I work with them. You know, I don't know everything at all. I just have my experience. And that's what I have to share. I do go through the book with girls because I find that I feel like we're all girls sometimes. Because it's a great way to kind of get to know each other as well as get to understand the program. So we kind of go through it slowly and we talk as we go. And it goes as fast or as slow as they need it to go. And I always emphasize that it's their program, you know. And I do reserve the right to, if something's not working, like if we're both not getting something out of the relationship, to have that conversation. It's not like getting married. It doesn't have to be dramatic. You know, it's like, you know, if all of a sudden somebody doesn't have what somebody else needs, let's at least talk about it, you know. And it's interesting. Recently, a couple gals with quite a bit of time had asked me to sponsor them. And I don't just say yes. I say, well, we can go have tea or something and talk about that. So I would talk to them and I'd say, well, my first question is, what's the deal with your current sponsor? Because almost inevitably they need to do a fourth step around their sponsor. So I'll say, you know, if you'd like to do that, I'd be happy to do that with you before you decide if you need a new sponsor. Because maybe you just need to work this thing out, you know. So that was just something I was thinking about sharing. Service is a humongous, humongous part of my sobriety, and it looks different at different times. We had a few years where I was either having babies or nursing, about 5. And during that time, I didn't go to as many meetings. I still went. I never left, but I went to less, and I did more on the phone and had grapevines and stuff like that. I shared with you earlier that I married another sober alcoholic that I met in here. He had a good and I don't think I'm telling his story saying this, but maybe I'll hear an earful later. He had a good decade, maybe more, maybe less, that he kind of a little bit checked out of this program. He stayed sober, but he kind of checked out. And it was hard for me. And I found out I needed another program to help with that and to keep me on my program and not on his. And in about the last year or so, he's come back and he's kind of come back hard. And it's been just such a really cool, huge miracle. And it had nothing to do with me. I mean, I could not have made him do anything, you know? And so I feel like sobriety at different stages has given me a lot of different challenges. And so the spiritual experience kind of keeps changing and growing if I'm willing. And that was a challenge that I remember facing. I think my time is probably, I write these notes and then I don't look at them. It's all just to like not feel so anxious. I just wanted to say that I only have a minute, I think, but my belief system, as I got sober and then as I stayed sober and as I worked steps and I watched people come alive in here, my belief system has radically changed. I really believed for a good part of my life that I was an alcoholic because A, B, C, D. And, you know, what I know today is that I'm an alcoholic because I'm an alcoholic. You know, I had a lot of traumatic crap happen to me when I was a kid, but that didn't make me an alcoholic. I think I had that kind of hard wiring, we'll just say, from the get-go. And certain amends that I've made have been way, way more powerful than others. The ones with my parents were dramatic. But the most powerful thing is kind of the ongoing living amends. Recently, my mother spent Thanksgiving with us, and my mom and I have had a chance to get really close. That hasn't happened with everybody in my family. I actually had to make some choices to let go of some people that were still behaving very abusively. But my mom and I have gotten really close. She was hanging out with me for Thanksgiving, and she had never, nobody in my family really had ever really acknowledged my sobriety. Not that they need to, right? If I was looking for that, I would have been screwed. I would not have stayed sober. But when I was 15 years sober, my mom gave me some books that were my grandma's. I guess my grandma had had a short period of sobriety right before she died. And it was the first time she'd ever done anything to acknowledge my sobriety. And she wrote me a letter. And it really moved me, but it also was just too hard to even talk about. And so this Thanksgiving, I had 18 years sober, and my mom was spending time with us. And I asked her, I said, "Mom, you know, I'm just curious. This isn't, I'm not criticizing, I'm just curious. Why did you never, you know, kind of acknowledge my sobriety or get excited about it or anything, you know?" And so this is kind of a joke. She totally straight face looked at me and said, "Well, honey, I thought it was just a phase, like communism or vegetarianism." So I'll leave you with that.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.